It planted, but I think it was planted perhaps just after we got here.
Yeah.
My uncle had picked the place out that he thought we would like, and it was a 20-acre tract right to, well, Manson Grange is on the, Grange Hall is on what was the west side of it, and it took in that whole flat there. But the trees were just whips. And, of course, you had to figure out some way to make a living. Well, that was drawing. And the engineering work wasn't as lucrative as my uncle had thought it would be.
So things were a little tight for a while, maybe.
Yeah.
What kind of things, obviously, I'm sure working in your own family's orchard would occupy a young man's time. But last time you were here, as I look back on it in retrospect, we talked a lot about the recreational things that were done and that kind of thing, which was fascinating. But did in those days, did families go out and find work to help make ends meet, that kind of thing?
Oh, yes. In fact, many of the original purchasers of land out there bought their land on what they called a work contract. And they went to work for the company that they bought the land from and get credit for the time that they put in on their contracts. We didn't happen to do that, but a great many of the men did. One rather odd thing, it seems odd now as I look back, there were an awful lot of bachelors, some of them not too young, that were buying places out there, and of course they worked out most of the time, except when they had something that they had to do at home. And of course, I think generally that was done before and after the work day.
Was there work to be done or to be had to go and find for to work for wages aside from orcharding out there in the Manson area at that time?
Well, actually, no. There weren't any payrolls as we know them today. Some things were developed later. Finally, the company realized that there had to be some other income, and the first thing they thought of was dairy cows. You could raise hay and between the trees, and it looked real good to them. But they didn't realize that the hay took the alfalfa took more water than the little trees did, and there were a lot of problems that developed, but they did build a creamery, and of course that gave work for two or three people.
Was that creamery a year-round operation? Do you remember?
Well,
it must have been to take care of the milk from the cows.
Milking that cow was sure a year-round operation.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was, but it didn't last too long. I just can't remember how long, but I would say not over 4 or 5 years.
Dixon, some of the older newspapers of that period, the predominant advertising was for Lucky Strike cigarettes, and for another, automobiles. But one of the major advertisers, or advertising groups, I should say, from really the 1890s on through many, many years, were various companies that made pumps, water pumps and such. And it seems that they were just about any design imaginable. How was it that you would get water to the orchards then, before the Manson Project was in and completed?
Well, our water came from up in the hills, and it was all gravity.
Mm-hmm.
So that, as far as pumps were concerned, there wasn't a pump in the system.
Okay, so by 1913, there was enough there in the way of...
That's right.
Ditches that had been dug and so on.
They had gone up, built a dam at what we call Anlon Lake. Long mm-hmm. Slough was the, I guess, the name of the dam.
Uh-huh.
And then all of the original orchard was down on the low ground. That water came down to Wapato Lake and then was spread out over the lower area of the district in dirt ditches. Later on, of course, we started putting in pipelines and so that our water was under pressure. But all those in those early days, it was all just gravity. You opened a little gate in the ditch and took your share of water and hoped to cover all your ground with it.
Well, now, your family's orchard, for instance, was, I imagine, fairly well toward the end of the line. You were down there near the lake. What would happen if the five or six guys up line from you all decided to take some water at the same time? Was there enough in the ditch to...
They had a ditch walker, we called him, and it was rationed out. We had some problems. The end fell lots of times. It had to wait a few days until some of the others got through. The biggest problem was down this way towards what we call Rocky Point. For some reason or other, that line always had more trouble than the one that went out our way.
But there
were problems, just like any new thing. And there, of course, some people get a little bit greedy. I paid for it, and I'm going to have it.
You wanted to water the garden as well as the orchard or something. Was that your domestic water as well, or did you use wells for that or what?
No. Most everybody had what they called a cistern, and they hauled water from the lake and filled their cisterns.
Wow. How big would one of those things have been? I've heard a lot of people talk about having to fill the cistern when they were kids, but it's larger than a coffee cup, obviously,
yeah,
but how big would it be?
Or even a bread box.
Yeah.
I think the average cistern probably would hold from 10 to 20,000 gallons. Ours was about 10 feet square, mm-hmm. made of concrete. We had water in the house. Even before we had a cistern built, my dad had parked the big tank that we hauled the water in up on the hill and just hooked a flexible coupling and then we had gravity pressure into the house. We had the first bathroom, and everybody thought we were crazy to put in the bathroom when we were hauling water, but we had it anyway.
Well, how about wintertime?
Couldn't
the cistern freeze up?
Created another problem. Well, the cisterns didn't, because most of those were buried. They were underground.
Okay.
But we had a little trouble keeping that tank from freezing. We'd hang a kerosene lantern under the connections, and every once in a while, I can remember, we'd have to go up and thaw the thing out before we'd have some water.
It seems to me, it sounds like hauling water might have been quite a bit of work for a young boy. Were you often involved in that?
Well, to some extent. It was a real chore. You'd back the tank out into the lake and bail it in. And in the wintertime, that wasn't very nice.
Yeah, man, I can imagine. This would be done by a horse-drawn wagon, I suppose, in those days, or... Would you do this with horses in those days?
Yes. Yeah. Oh yeah, we had a little team of mules and they weren't very big. Sometimes if we'd have to back out quite a ways, the sand wasn't very good footing. A few times we also had a team of Shetland ponies, and Dad had hooked them on in front, so we had a four horse team, and. Backing that four-horse team out in the lake was a little trick, too.
I'll bet it was, yeah.
But, of course, this was all new to him. He had to learn a lot of those things, because he'd never done those kind of things before. He knew how to run a transit or a level, but farming was something new for him.
Do you have any memory at all of the first time you tried to hook up a team of horses or anything like that? Or had you been around it enough you just picked it up by osmosis by the time you had to do it?
Well, I had a pony that I drove to a two-wheel cart. And sometimes he wasn't too cooperative. So I learned kind of the hard way. But and then I learned after he went home without me a few times when I was delivering a bottle of milk to somebody's doorstep that you couldn't always trust a horse.
You mean he would leave you alone?
Did that more than once.
Is that right?
Yeah. Of course, one time he broke up quite a few bottles of milk, and I remember I got a pretty good lecture over it that time.
Now, is this milk that your family would produce, or would?
Yes.
I see.
Yeah, we. One way of trying to help make a living is deliver milk to people around town.
One of our listeners, after you were on last week, Dick, said that to the effect that if you were in their family, one of the things that they would like to ask you about would be what the literally what the home life was in the 19-teens in the Manson area, about the home itself, the equipment that was available there, the kind of work that it took for your mom or maybe for your whole family just to operate a house.
Well, as I remember, we didn't lack too many of the conveniences of the day. My mother had been raised back east, so she was had gone to school at Radcliffe, and then she worked on a newspaper in Boston for a little while, and so she was used to things that a lot of the people around Manson weren't used to. My dad was raised in Seattle, but he had been outdoors most of his life and had had a lot of experiences living outdoors, camping and boarding, and when they were working on survey crews and things. But this was all fairly new to my mother. One of my uncles, Walter Olive, became manager of the company out there, and he was always bringing company home for lunch. And didn't seem to matter how many people he brought home, mother always managed to find something for them to eat. And we children learned to help, and I don't remember that living was the tough deal that you hear people talk about.
What would have been the kitchen equipment in the average home in the Manson area in the teens? I know that there was electricity around then,
no.
But did most people have an electric range or refrigerator or whatever?
Not until, we didn't get electricity out there until about 1921, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a wood stove, and I think wood was close here. We burned quite a little coal. We'd haul coal out from town here. Not all the time, but there was a wood heater in the living room. The bedrooms weren't heated.
Would you have used the stove itself as a supplementary heater for the home as well as for cooking, by any chance?
Well, no question, but the kitchen stove helped heat the whole house. In fact, if I remember right, we kids mostly dressed in the kitchen because that was the first place in the morning that it was warm.
Mm-hmm.
But you hear people talk about the rough times, and I don't remember that. It seemed like we always had things pretty nice, and we sure appreciated it.
Yeah, it was as modern as everything else.
Yeah.
Then. I mean, you know, you brought back a memory of my own there, dressing in the kitchen, and I was raised with a wood furnace,
yeah.
And we always dressed on the register.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It wasn't until I grew up that I was grateful to my parents that they didn't take the time to dress on the register. They stayed out where it was cold. But I never thought of that then.
No.
But, you know, in the typical humble apartments you can walk into today, you might find three different kinds of spatulas and all kinds of cooking utensils and such. The kinds of things that your mother had to work with, would they be the same kitchen tools that we use now?
Oh, I don't think... I think there's been a lot of improvements in those things. Like, I have a little rubber spatula that I like to use when I'm scrambling eggs and things. And she didn't have one of those, I know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember we had some wooden spoons. Not, I don't think they were necessary. Certainly they were. But we didn't have stainless steel in those days. The cooking utensils were graniteware, and if you weren't careful, it chipped. And there were a lot of little things like that that certainly have been improved on. Didn't have any of these so-called food machines that are the rage today, or blenders, those kind of things.
Yeah.
But I think we had just as many, just as much whipped cream and those kind of things, even though it was a hand beater. So people just did with what they had, and as you say, everybody else had the same thing. So it
didn't seem like a hardship.
No.
Yeah. You mentioned your mother had worked at a newspaper back east, or something.
Yes,
like that?
she had an uncle who was a publisher of a newspaper in Boston, and she had dreamed of being a newspaper woman. And she worked for him after graduating from college for a time, I'm not sure how long. Then she took a vacation and came out here to visit her brother, and she never did get back to Boston. She just stayed out here. And, of course, it was a whole new life for her.
Yeah. Did she ever get into or talk about getting back into maybe newspapering in some way? Was she a woman who would have enjoyed a professional life?
Well, I think she would have, but I think in the real early days she did write an article or two for one of the early newspapers in Wenatchee, but she never did get back into it and never did become involved in a professional way.
Mm-hmm.
She had six children in pretty rapid succession, and that kind of stopped any ideas that she might have had.
Yeah.
And of course, when we came up here, there wasn't any opportunity to do much of those kind of things.
Between raising children and making all those TV dinners from scratch, I imagine she was pretty busy anyway.
That's true.
We're talking this morning with Dick Warden, talking from the crockery. We're going to take a break for a couple of minutes, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes. Hosting us during our month of heritage. In fact, we've had some rather nice breakfasts here in Morning Pass, so I invite folks to stop in. Our guest this morning is Dick Ward. Dick is a virtual lifelong resident of the Manson area. How old were you, Dick, when you moved to Manson in 1913?
Nine.
Yeah, well, it's virtually lifelong then.
Yeah.
A little bit more about maybe what your home life was like. Some of the folks that we brought in have, I think most of us have favorite memories of our parents or our sibling rivals or whatever. What was the evening like in the Ward home when you were a boy? What did you do in the evening?
We used to, my folks like to read. And Dad used to read to us kids almost every evening.
Uh-huh.
Unless he was just too worn out. But, and of course, I was the oldest one of the family, and so he was still reading to some of the younger ones after I thought I was too old for that.
They had replays then too, didn't they?
Right. But
what
the Saturday Evening Post was in our home as long as I can remember, and he had the authors and the Post that he particularly liked, and some of those stories he'd read to us, and of course many of the things he read were children's publications. And there was a magazine, hadn't thought about it for years, and I suppose I can't say the name of it now. It was, I think, a monthly periodical that was designed for young people.
Would that have been Boy's Life?
Boy's Life, that's it, yeah.
I remember seeing those.
Yeah. Of course, we're still, Boy's Life's still being published.
Uh-huh.
But there was another one. Youth Companion. Youth Companion.
Okay, I've heard people mention that too, yeah. Yeah.
I haven't heard of that for a long, long time. But we didn't have radio, of course, and I don't remember that we had a phonograph until I was probably in high school. And then the music that I liked wasn't too popular with my mother. I remember that. And when some of the fellows had come in and we'd play some of the records that I had, sometimes we'd have to tone it down a little bit. But we had a wonderful home life. My parents were, never remember hearing them argue about things. We did pretty well what we knew we were supposed to do. Table manners were pretty important. And
at the table in the evening, for your evening meal, was there a lot of talking, discussion? Is that where the family business was done? What?
Yes, considerable. One of the problems during quite a bit of that time was that there were generally some strangers, because of the fact that my uncle lived with us and he had he was always bringing people in, and sometimes they spent the night, and so those kind of things kind of interrupted. We never knew who he was going to bring. Senator Jones, who was one of our real early senators, spent some time with us because his son was an attorney. And they were involved in the land company, and they'd come over to. And Leroy Backus, whose father was heavily involved financially, was in the banking business in Seattle. They spent considerable time there. We always had somebody around.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm not. I don't remember that we had too much time. Of course, we surely did have. But
sure.
As I recall, it seemed like there was always somebody around.
Were your folks the type of people who were? Did they take an interest in world affairs and such? Was there a daily newspaper available to you then, for instance?
I don't remember when we started getting a daily newspaper. Certainly they weren't when we first came up here.
Yeah.
But
would have been a
yes, they were.
Anyway.
They were keenly interested in world affairs and politics. They were both staunch Republicans, and I don't know whether always had been or not, but I guess that's one reason why I've always been. But
well, now I'll have to talk to you about that later.
Yeah, I thought I'd probably get an answer from you on that.
Dick, you know, when you see television about Pioneer Days, Dad was the boss and Mom ran the kitchen. Is that an accurate description of your family?
Pretty much. Mother didn't get out in the orchard and help like a lot of people. I don't think many of the ladies did in those real first
early
time.
Years,
the next generation, though, the women get out side by side and help rake brush and prune or whatever had to be done. As you say, the house was the mother's domain and the orchard was Dad's.
Let's jump ahead a little bit. In 1927, the dam came in here, and the last time you were here, we talked about the effect that had on the community of Manson. But to start with, by 1927, what were you doing? By the late 20s, were you into your own orchard by then, or what?
I had a small place of my own, but in 1927 I was working for my wife's aunt, running her 20 acres. In 1924 I bought a cherry orchard that I saw sticking up through the weeds that had been planted a year or two before, and I didn't realize it was there, and I found out that it belonged to some people in Wenatchee, and I was able to make a deal for it. So I was taking care of that weekends and early and late, and working for Mrs. Banks on her 20 acres, which in along about 1930 or 31 we bought from her.
So by the late 20s you were sort of self-employed and sort of employed elsewhere.
That's right. Yeah. Now, except for a few years about that time, and 8 years that I worked for the state on inspection, I've been self-employed all my life.
Now, in 27, when the dam was under construction, there was obviously a big impact in terms of the number of people in the Chelan community and so on, and we've dealt with that quite a bit in past years. But I'm wondering how people who didn't live in the city of Chelan might have been affected by things like construction crews coming in. An awful lot of attention was paid, at least to the Chelan community, even by, well, even national press coming in to look at the remarkable long tunnel and that kind of thing. Was there any impact at all like that in the Manson area, the construction of the dam?
I don't remember that there was. There was one little project, clearing the lake shore, and they did most of that during one winter, and quite a few of the local people worked on that. In fact, I worked on it for a month or so. It brought in a little extra money, and it was
You did that, who were you working for? Do you remember? Were you working for Washington Water Power Company, or as a volunteer, or what?
We were working for
Grant and Osborne, the construction people, or whatever.
Yeah.
Was that their name? I can't remember.
Grant somebody.
Yeah.
I'm sure we were working for them. Mm-hmm. There was quite a crew. In fact, I think they had two crews. We went out on a boat every morning.
Yeah.
And it was quite an experience. There were all kinds of people. Some people who had come in. But it was cold, and they had the boat closed up pretty close. And there was a lot of pretty heavy tobacco smoke. There was one old fellow that smoked cigar clippings in his pipe.
Oh, boy.
Man, oh, man, if that wasn't out.
And even outdoors, that'd get
you. There was another old fellow, forget his name now, a real character. He smoked Peerless in his pipe.
And for the benefit of those who don't know.
Somebody pull up the canvas and stick their nose out and get some fresh air.
what was Peerless?
That was a pipe tobacco that was really strong.
Just a particularly pungent pipe tobacco.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know if they make it anymore or not. I haven't seen any for a long time.
It has often seemed to me, Dick, that the project of clearing a lakeshore for I don't know how many linear feet in some areas, depending on the slope of the bank at the time, for a lake that's 55 miles long would have been just about as big a project as building the dam.
Well, it must have been a real project. I know it was. And of course, I worked on it, and as I remember, we were interested in the lower end of the lake.
Yeah.
And I think that thing probably went on for maybe a couple of years or more before they got it all cleaned up.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of work. They were supposed to have cut trees down so that the stumps wouldn't show, but of course the erosion came, and you can still see stumps sticking up here and there that weren't supposed to be. They didn't have too much equipment available, and you couldn't get some of that equipment in to pull those stumps, and then so they just sawed them off as close as they could.
Do you remember what happened to the trees once they were cut? Was it free wood for anybody wanted to come and take it, or what?
I think it must have been. I don't remember that. Yeah. There were some orchards down here in Spader's Bay, for instance. That was all orchard years before that. Mm-hmm. Not a big block, but all that orchard went out, and you could see those stumps for a while. They're pretty well gone now. And I think up around 25 Mile Creek, which was one of the real early orchard areas, long before the Manson Project, there were orchards that had to be moved. But so much of our lake shore was steep, and so it was mostly just, in fact, a lot of it just nothing but rock, so there really wasn't much to remove.
Yeah. I know that Kenny Kingman had just taken over the local paper at that time, and in his editorial columns, he was quite concerned about, you know, whose job is it to clear the lake, and apparently there was quite a debate in the community over who should be responsible and that kind of thing.
I think if the community hadn't taken some interest in it, probably never would have been cleared.
Yeah.
I mean, that was something that I don't think was really thought about when they started the project.
Now, you were a man in your mid-20s when dam construction started there. What was that, 26, something like that? Do you remember that as being just the idea of having a dam here, a hydro dam here, was that controversial at all? You know, like it would be today if somebody said we want to put a dam in somewhere. Was there much discussion around the community about that?
I don't remember that there was. We didn't have the activists in those days to get up on a...
Well, I was thinking of things like there were several businesses, as you mentioned last time you were here, that the business district, such as it was in Manson, would now be underwater. It had to be moved and that kind of thing. Did that create any controversy?
I suppose that there was problems, but apparently I didn't get involved in any of it, and I don't remember too much of it.
You know,
I know when the power came out to Manson along about 1921 or 22, people were so anxious to get that power that they would have done almost anything, you know. Same way with our road when they raised the dam. Nobody thought about having them build a decent road around the lake. They just pushed it back a little further, and just as many crooks in it as there was before. After it was all over, then we wonder, why didn't we have them build a decent road, and a lot of things like that.
Some folks still wonder about it today. That must have been a real delight for some people. Look at the old newspaper ads, and I think you could buy a Hot Point range for $5 or $6 down and $7.95 a month or something like that.
Yeah. But you had to guarantee to use it or else pay a minimum light bill that would cover.
Oh, is that right?
The main reason why they pushed ranges was to have enough revenue to pay for that power line.
Sure.
And, so everybody had a minimum power bill, whether they used it or not.
I see. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. Oh, one thing one other area I wanted to ask you about before we got too far forward, and that was just as I came in today, you handed me some literature about your family, and I noticed a booklet there written by Eva Anderson about Clarence Ward, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Pioneer surveyor?
Yeah.
Who was he?
He was my father.
He was your father?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
And
the other one is the story of his father's trip across the plains in 1853, I think it was.
Was that a diary that was written, the trip across the plains, or something that was...
It wasn't a diary. In fact, he didn't write it until years and years after he was out here and grown up, but his family kept after him, and other people thought he ought to put down on paper some of the things that happened, and that was published by a little publisher in Seattle, and then later on Eva Anderson or Wilfred Woods republished it. Eva wasn't involved in that, but she did write the story of my father.
Of course, I haven't had an opportunity to look that over, but the story of the trip across the plains looks like it's, you know, fairly sizable publication there.
Well, the original book was a little, maybe 6x8 booklet, yeah, with a rustic type cover on it, and there were a good many of those published, and I've even lost my original copy, but I do have copies that Wilford gave me. In fact, he had a bunch left over, and he sent me a whole box full of them at one time.
Well, with your permission, then, we might go through that and maybe use some excerpts from it on the air later on in the Month of Heritage or something, because I'm sure it was an exciting trip across the United States in the 1850s.
A lot of people today don't realize really what that trip, the hardships that were encountered. Some wagon trains came through without too much, you know, really real problems, and others ran into massacres and all kinds of problems. They didn't have any real problems, but my grandmother, who came out the same year in a different train, her group wound up down at Mound Prairie, and she was involved in that Indian massacre in that area about a year after they got out here, I think. So those early people had some rough times.
Yeah, they did. Well, we'll go through some of that stuff and maybe pull some excerpts out and talk about, there's a lot of information about what happened to people after they got here, but what happened to them on the way is kind of scarce. One thing I wanted to ask you about, though, was 1929. There was a tremendous forest fire in the area then, in which Nanny St. Louis was killed and so on.
Yeah.
Were you in the Manson area at that time? I assume you were.
Yes.
Do you remember that fire?
I got involved in that to a pretty good extent. The fire started on a Saturday night, as I remember, and the Forest Service people all, of course, went up there, got working on it, and they got on the other side of the fire and couldn't get out, and had no radio or anything. Marion Parrish, who was an old-timer here on the lake and had worked for the Forest Service but had some problems and had been let out, he had a little restaurant out of Manson at that time. He came out the house and said, maybe we ought to see if we can't be some help. So we came down to the office, asked them what we could do to help, and they said, my golly, get up there and see what you can do to straighten out that base camp and try to get some organization, because all of their people were on the other side.
So we basically went up. They had no one who was available to be in charge.
Right.
Ah, okay.
We went up to the base camp, which had just been thrown together in a hurry by volunteers, and Marion, who had a lot more experience than I had, said, you take over here, and I'll go out on the line and see what I can do.
Can you give me a rough idea? I know it's been a long time, but can you give me a rough idea of where that fire burned and you know, the kind of dimensions it is, so that our listeners have some idea in their head as to where the fire was?
Well, it started down on the lake shore at about Great Creek, and then went up the hill and didn't go up lake much further than that, but it crowned up on top and went down into the Methow, into Black Canyon, and clear down over that whole country back of Manson.
Yeah.
It covered a big area.
Would that have been your first experience at trying to deal with a forest fire?
No, I had been out on some fires, not a big fire. I was on the what we call the surprise fire in 25 Mile Creek some years before that. I seemed like I wound up being a timekeeper or a cook's helper or something more often than I did out on the fire line.
That must have been kind almost a fearful thing to have someone say, well, if you guys can take charge of the base camp, it would be appreciated, and send you out the door. What did you do when you got there?
it really was, because I wasn't, I was still pretty young and inexperienced, and most of the people that I was dealing with were older people than I was, and I'd been brought up to respect my elders, and I wasn't used to ordering them around. But I did. I took over the camp, and just were lucky to have some people on hand that could do the cooking. I had a good man who had worked for me in the orchard, who was a pretty good cook, and he took over the night crew, their night shift. And we did have a phone there. About 2 days after I got up there, a man came in from Portland, who just happened to be in the area, a Forest Service man. Don't remember his name now, but he was, I think he was range inspector or something. He wasn't a fireman, but he was a high official, regional, and so I leaned on him, but he said, you're in charge. The truckers got into an argument about who was going to haul this and who was going to haul that, and I hardly knew what to do. He said, whatever you do is the thing. So I got them together, and we worked out a schedule, and he sat back. He wouldn't interfere.
I don't know the acreage of that fire anymore. I don't remember it. Do you remember it by any chance?
No.
I do know that it still ranks as one of the biggest fires that's burned in this area, at least one of the biggest. Now, today they've got helicopters and radio communication systems and aerial drops and all kinds of things, but what did it take organizationally to put together an effort and operate out of a base camp? Do you have any idea how many people were involved or anything like that?
Well, we had... I think we were feeding about 300 men out of our camp, and then we had a couple other camps. And it just took a lot of manpower and sawyers. They'd fall trees to try to get them so they wouldn't create more fire. Clear a path, and then if the weather was right, well, they'd backfire against this trail. It was all manpower. We didn't have a tractor on the job, which today that's one of the first things they get in there.
I don't imagine you could take your average fire truck around either. It must have been mainly shovel work, huh?
Right. That's the old the tool that they all kind of depended on was what they called a Pulaski. It was an axe on one side and a fairly narrow grub hole on the other side. Cut brush or cut trees. And that was the tool that most of the fellows used. There were lots of shovels.
Now, you say you fed 300 people. That must have been a chore in itself on a daily basis to prepare a couple of meals a day or whatever.
Yeah, it was, and you had to have fellows who could visualize what they were going to need, and we had a truck going back and forth picking up stuff here, and I'd call in orders, or sometimes just make up an order, and the truck driver would bring it down, but generally I'd call ahead, so the orders would be ready when they came, and in after them. There were an awful lot of details to take care of.
I bet there were.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the truckers. Were these folks who just happened to have trucks and put them into service? Or?
Yes, there were several people in the area who some of them were growers that picked up a bunch of volunteers and took them up there, and we just kept them up there because they'd haul the men out back and forth on the road. Our camp was right on the old Flume Road, and so we did have access in that far. However, the roads were dry, and the dust got so deep that it was terrible. But we had probably four or five trucks available. The thing they were arguing about was what were they going to get paid for standby time and those kind of things, and that was one of the problems that had to get worked out. But
was that a thing where the Forest Service, did they reimburse most of those people that volunteered, or?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Almost always. After that, we had little what we called emergency crews, and they nearly always got paid. Sometimes they'd go out as soon as the Forest Service could get permanent personnel out there. Well, then the farmers would go back home and go to work. But they turned in their time. It wasn't a lot of money in those days.
I don't imagine in a case of a fire of that magnitude that there probably was ever a time when the Forest Service could provide the full crew it took, was there?
Oh, no. No, of course, nowadays they bring in trained crews from all over the area, you know. But they didn't have those kind of things. They had what they call a flying squadron, which was made up of four people from different areas of the district, technical people. Mm-hmm. There was one engineer, and they'd fly in, or they'd get them in as quick as they could, and they'd kind of take charge. Mm-hmm. I had an opportunity to go with them after that fire, and I sometimes wondered why I didn't. But had a little better education, I might have. But if you don't have a degree in forestry, well, you don't get too far in the Forest Service.
Yeah. Now, if somebody's going to ask me about this, I know, so I better do this before I forget. When we first started talking about this fire, you mentioned that there was a Forest Service crew that was on the far side of the fire, and they couldn't get home from there. What happened to those guys?
Well, as soon as the fire burned across the road, and maybe they didn't use the road altogether, mm-hmm. but they had transportation up there, but nowhere to go. So as soon as the fire had gone by, well, they came back down. The Forest Ranger, practically the whole crew from the district ranger's office was up there. But it was just a matter of two or three days until they were all down doing their thing again. And they had a few men with them. I don't remember now how big a crew. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember now how they got any supplies. Probably had to pack them up from the lake.
Now, a lot of people here in the Chelan community knew Nanny St. Louis well. I think you graduated from high school the year before. Did you know Nanny?
Yes. Oh, yes. In fact, the gentleman I spoke of from Portland was the fellow that was with Nanny.
That's what I was going to ask you.
Yes, I saw them as they left camp. And they took a lunch with them, and we talked about some things mm-hmm. that we should do during the day. But this gentleman wanted to get out and see what the fire was actually doing. And that was their fatal trip.
As I recall, I don't know if I read it or someone told me, when they were finally found, there was some evidence, at least, that maybe they tried to get up a draw, that the gentleman who was with Nanny obviously wasn't in the shape of the young high school athlete, and Nanny came back down the hillside, and they were found with Nanny laying over him trying to protect him. How long were they missing before they were found? Do you remember hearing that there are two men in trouble up there? Do you remember when you heard that?
Well, I
kind of feeling went through the camp.
We became concerned before the day was over, because some of the crews came in and said this fire crowned over that whole area. They said that fire was a half a mile in the air, and just they didn't know how far ahead it was of the ground. And of course, a lot of times fighting fire, you're working under that kind of a situation, right? With fire over your head, and you're working on the ground. Mm-hmm. But we were concerned that they were lost before the day was over. And of course, right away, I sent people out to look for them. And the district ranger and those people, of course, were available then. But I don't remember now, just how long it was before we actually found them.
Yeah, I know it was a matter of days. For those who are listening that are wondering what we're talking about, we have talked with some other people who were in the same general area and had met in past years and had talked with Manny St. Louis and the gentleman from Portland and so on. But basically what happened was the fire crowned out, created a vacuum, and I think they suffocated. Yeah. I don't think they were actually burned. But how long did it take you to wrap that thing up? How long did the fire burn?
The Forest Service had people working until snowfall. Orville Williams, who was still in town here, was on one of those crews. He and one other fellow, if I remember right, were still working on that fire when they came in because of snow.
Is that right?
Mopping up. It was such a hot thing, and it just created so much heat in this ground that it was just hard to put things out.
Basically, then I think it was in what, July? Early July?
Second of August it started,
okay. That's a long time to fight a fire.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember how long the camp operated, or how long at least you were involved in the camp?
I was up there the first 6 days that I was there. I didn't get time to take my boots off. Worked around it. I think I was up there about 10 days, and then I just had to come out. There were things to do in the orchard that... And that... I don't remember how long that camp was there after that. I imagine at least another week. Maybe 2 weeks, because... Of course, the fire went on beyond, you know, and that base camp became a... kept getting further away from the fire all the time.
Sure.
And I think there were some other camps set up, smaller camps.
We're talking this morning with Dick Ward from the Crockery, and I know that there were some significant aftermath from that fire, particularly as it pertained to irrigating in Manson. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But first, let's take another commercial break here, and we'll be back. Our commercial there was just talking about nature's best effort to create Lake Chelan. Of course, we've been talking about nature's best effort to burn it down. But there were some really significant after effects of that fire from what I've been able to read. And that is that it burned a substantial portion of the open wooden flumes and so on that were part of the Manson Project. How did that affect the area out there, Dick?
Well, it affected it tremendously from a financial standpoint. First, it just so happened that we'd had a good winter and a good spring, and the Anlon Reservoir was practically full. Had it been a dry spring, and we could have been in real trouble. I don't recall that many of the orchards suffered from lack of water, but it was quite a while before they get that flume repaired and get water back in. It cost about $70 an acre to do that, and the district was able to borrow some money from the state Department of Conservation and Development, I think it was, who had a little slush fund that they kept for that purpose, and we were able to borrow enough money to build that flume. But we paid it back in one installment the next year, and that was really rough for a lot of people. $70 an acre, besides...
That $70 acre per acre assessment was for all the users of the project?
Right, right.
Wow. That's higher. That's a lot higher than your local taxes right now. I mean, gee whiz.
Oh, yes.
That's a lot of money.
I think at that time we were probably paying around... I don't remember. Maybe $30 an acre maintenance for maintenance and operation. Well, then this $70 is on top of that. Mm-hmm. And that created a real problem for a lot of people. In fact, I'm sure a lot of it wasn't paid right away.
I know that there was a lot, there were several articles that really went over a period of a couple of years, I believe, about efforts to try to get state or even federal relief for some of those people. Maybe it was reimbursement funds or whatever. But it became quite a hot issue, apparently, that people locally were trying to say, wait a minute here. You know?
Yeah. Well, it seemed like we were always looking for some relief of some kind. Yeah. And those times were a little rough anyway. Mm-hmm. Just the beginning of the Depression then, and I think about that time this seed loan that people used to kind of laugh about was an emergency mm-hmm. growers loan, and kind of a one year deal. I think $400 was the maximum on it. It didn't mm-hmm. amount to very much, but a good many people availed themselves of it. And,
you know, one thing that has struck me over the years, Dick, about, I guess, history anywhere in America has been from about 1929 through, well, the end of the Korean War, there seemed to be just about one crisis after another in the United States as a whole. I would suppose in this area, you'd started in 29 with a fire, and then the stock market crash came before the fire was out in October of that year. Did times get really tough in the orcharding industry at the turn of that decade from 29?
Well, there's no question about it. Times were so rough all over that it affected the apple market, which and of course that's affected our whole economy here in the valley. There were lots of apples shipped east that didn't bring the freight. We had no organization for selling our fruit. It was a kind of a dog eat dog thing, and when you hit hard times, it just hit nearly everybody.
Yeah.
Of course, we had had some tough years prior to that. I remember in 1922, I think, was the last crop that my folks picked off of their orchard, and it was still pretty young, but they had a carload of real beauties that didn't bring freight. And then that happened to a lot of people. They'd couldn't find a market, but the bank or whoever they borrowed some money from needed it. So they'd load up a car and put it on wheels and hope to sell it before it get to the wrong place. I remember the last real problem I had was two cars of Spitzenbergs, which is a variety that not many people were growing here at that time, but a wonderful apple. There was one company in New York that sold practically all the Spitzenbergs, and they went to quit business. And a lot of markets didn't know what they were.
Mm-hmm.
These two cars, prettiest cart of fruit that I ever saw, and the broker that shipped them said we won't have any trouble with those. Those are beautiful. Those apples hit the East Coast. They thought they'd move them in Baltimore or somewhere in there, and they shuffled those things back and forth for quite a while, and I finally got a bill for freight on them. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't remember now just what year that was. That was 32 or 3, I think, probably along in there.
Would you consider yourself a man who, you've been involved with orchard land all your life, would you consider yourself are you an orchardist because it's the business you know, or are you an orchardist because of an affinity for the land and the growing process?
Probably.
How's that for an off-the-wall question?
I really think that probably because of the more or less independent nature of the business. You're your own boss. Even in those times when you just held your hand out and said, what'll he give me? We were still pretty independent. We could make mistakes and nobody could, you could either do it or you don't do it. Since then, times have, that aspect of the business has changed so much that it's not the same at all. And it's a pleasure now, where some of the times it used to be far from it, the marketing end of it. But, if I was working on a job this morning, I'd be on the job instead of visiting with you. But yeah. In the orchard, you can take some time when something important comes along, or not so important sometimes.
Yeah.
I think that's the reason why a lot of people are in the orchard business. It's you're your own boss, and you're outdoors where you're not tied down to a desk. Sometimes you don't make a lot of money. And I never have made a lot of money, but I've probably spent too much time Boy Scouting and a few of those kind of things when I should have been home working.
Dick, when you think of the Depression years, whether it pertains to agriculture or not, what do you remember most about the 1930s? What things stick in your mind the most? Or do you find yourself thinking about when you're shaving now and then or whatever?
Well, I think the thing that bothered me mostly was the fact that I wasn't always able to pay my bills. Mm-hmm. I remember taking the electric range out and putting in a wood stove because we could burn apple wood and those kind of things. You just weren't able to do the things that you, as far as living's concerned, we ate pretty good and we had a lot of fun because everybody was in the same situation and we'd get together with potluck parties and actually some of the best times that we had as a family was during those times because people just got along.
Was that an experience that drew the community together, that mutual experience of tough times and so on? Was there a difference in did people get more friendly, whatever?
Oh, I think so. I don't think there's any question about that. I'm sure that there were friendships made during those times that were everlasting, because you help people with each other with their problems, and it was bound to had a good effect. That have had all those things paid for, they're still making money.
Another thing in the Depression that we hear about a lot, at least, is the fireside chats. Franklin Roosevelt. Mm. I've always wanted to ask a Republican about those. Did you? Did were they Were they big events when they did occur?
I don't think I ever missed one. I didn't always agree with what he was, you know, but no, I think it was something that people look forward to. No question what he could really talk to people and get over his ideas.
You know, it's a well-used quote now. Anytime anybody mentions President Roosevelt, the first quote you hear is, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," from his first inaugural address in 1932. He obviously felt that on a national scale that was a very important message to get across. Was there anything in the local community that you would term as akin to a real fear because of the economy? Were people afraid that maybe this system as we knew it was not going to survive?
I don't have any recollection of anything of that kind. I don't think too many people, particularly probably more rural people especially, ever gave up.
The city dwellers.
Somebody. I had a letter yesterday from Jerry Falwell. Mm-hmm. He says American flag's going down the drain. Well, I don't believe that. I don't think Jerry does either. But he's trying to put across a point, and I think most Americans are so sold on our country that we may be radically or vehemently opposed to some things that are going on, but we still believe in it. But I don't remember that we thought it was going down the drain then. I don't today.
You mentioned earlier that you're in fact, you're saying during one of the commercial breaks, you've got some scouting work to do today. Have you been able to? Were you able, I should say, as an orchardist in the 20s, 30s, maybe the 40s? Was there time for people who were engaged in agriculture then to become involved in community affairs, Kiwanis clubs, and the like?
Oh yes, I think so. I think people generally find time to do what they want to do.
Yeah.
Whether it's fishing or boating, or Kiwanis, or scouting, or church. There's a way to find time to do those things. At one time, I was paying off a mortgage on that I assumed when we took over the place we were living on. The mortgage holder called me in and said, you're spending too much time on some extracurricular things. That we're going to have to insist that you drop some of those and spend more time at the orchard. And I suppose maybe I wasn't the only person that ever happened to, but people, I've been working in scouting ever since 1938, I think, or 39, along in there, and a lot of other people have too, so you find time to do those things.
Do you remember any of the first Boy Scouts you worked with in those days? Are they folks that are still around?
Yeah, a lot of them are still around. Faye Smith, Vern Steele, some of the fellows are gone. One of my first Scoutmasters, which goes way back further than 38, is still living. He isn't here now. He's living with his daughter over in Cooley City. But a lot of people are gone that you didn't know. But Louis Sorensen, his son Roger, and Louis worked in scouting for years and years. He was a scoutmaster and troop committee and. Arnold Koenig, who you know, was one of our scoutmasters. I could name a lot of them.
You know, that's one area of World War II that we haven't gotten into very much. Were you involved in scouting during the war?
Yeah.
There were all kinds of different programs that people volunteered for and so on. Did the Boy Scouts take any kind of active role in civil defense and that kind of thing?
I don't think in the rural communities it did much. Not like the boys did in some of the big metropolitan areas. They had definite things that they could do.
I know in some of the cities they went out and collected people's newspapers and things like that and scrap.
We did those kind of things. Yeah. In fact, we're still picking up newspapers, and when a troop funds get down a little bit low, we have a paper drive.
Yeah.
But of course, we did it then because we needed to save those things. And, but I don't remember that we were involved in too many things. It was a little bit harder to hold things together because of the war. You know, financing the council was quite a problem, and we had to cut back on some activities. In fact, it still is a problem, but not because of war. It just takes a lot of money to finance a scout council, and local troops managed to shift for themselves to take care of their own local expenses, but when you get into council financing, it's quite a little problem.
One thing that we almost traditionally ask people who were around then is related to the war, and I know we're running out of time, but we can get into it a little bit. Do you remember what you were doing when you heard about Pearl Harbor on December 7th of 41? Do you remember? Is that a day that stands out in your mind?
I heard somebody ask that just the last day or two, and somebody else, and I tried to think what I was doing, and I don't remember. It's odd that I don't, but I thought about it all day yesterday.
In the early stages of the war, Were there things that surprised you or local people? You know, there were, as I read some of those newspapers from 42, which really is the first year of the war, I see headlines that I would think, I think one of them I remember was one of the earlier things to be rationed. The first I think was tires. And I remember thinking, if I were reading that headline on the day it was published, I would say, what is this about not being able to buy tires? Were there things like that that surprised you, where you said, what do they need this for, or anything like that?
Well, I'm sure there was tires and gasoline.
In fact, I think for 1 month, when they set the quota, you could for Chelan County north of Wenatchee, there were two new tires that could be bought that month.
Yeah, it was real tight.
Yeah,
real tight. I bought a truck, and it sure took a lot of red tape to get that. In fact, there were only two trucks sold in the county that year, and I happened to be lucky enough to get one of them. And there were a lot of those kind of things that we griped about, because we felt that too many people were taking advantage of some positions they had, and everybody wasn't being penalized the same. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I always thought that like a lot of things, that the other fellow's getting the best deal.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I imagine that feeling was pretty much universal across the country,
sure,
I suppose. But
I'm sure it was. But actually, I don't remember that we never had, that we actually ran out of gasoline or had to put up a piece of equipment because we couldn't get a tire for it. We'd manage some way or other. Probably had some boots and some tires that you wouldn't consider safe, but we made out all right.
Was there a significant change in in the lifestyle in the Manson area that was brought on by World War II? Or did, would there be anything that a person could put his finger on and say, yeah, that really changed for a couple of years?
Well,
did you eat less meat, for instance, that kind of thing? Have to change your diet, that kind of thing?
I don't think so. Up until that time, a good many of the growers, the orchardists, had a milk cow, raised some chickens. We always had some stock on hand, raised some hogs, and so I don't think those kind of things hurt us too much. May have been individual families that created some problems, but I don't recall that that we had any problem.
Dick, I don't know why it is, but it seems like both times when we've sat down to talk with you, the clock has run twice as fast as it should. And here we are approaching 11 o'clock already, so I guess we'd better just wrap it up. But again, I want to thank you very much for taking these two mornings to come in and talk with us. We really appreciate your time.
Well, I thank you, and I'm sure there are other people who are wondering, well, why didn't he say this, or why didn't he say that? No, that isn't the way it was.
Yeah, that's kind of,
I've enjoyed it.
That's an interesting point, because there are other people, I'm glad you brought that up, there are other people in the community whom we'll be asking to come on, and you know, as probably you can tell when we sit here and talk, we're not really after the world's foremost authority on a particular thing. We're after just enjoyable conversation, so I hope folks won't be afraid to come in. We've certainly enjoyed it with you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Dick. We've been talking with Dick Ward this morning, and this morning's conversation from the crockery, and that's about it for today, folks.